Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
About 24,000 children will be diagnosed with autism this year, and sometimes it's less about the child than it is about the parents and their ability to cope with a disorder.
The parents of autistic children often stick together, and we have to.
They have no idea how easy it is compared to this. And all, your heart is breaking all day long. You know, you think about his future and all the pain he's in, and I don't think they can understand that.
Voices of parents from the film Autism Every Day talk about the exhaustion and the frustration and the heartbreak that comes with having an autistic child. There's a lot of information out there about autism. Not all of it is true. We've got the straight facts for you about autism and what works to treat it. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 15th, President's Day. Happy holiday. And I am joined here by Todd Zwillick today, or filling in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste.
Takeaway for me, of course, is that with any disorder, with any medical condition, there's going to be some disagreement. It's going to be confusing.
Plenty. And with autism and autism spectrum disorder, it's so broad and so complicated, it only adds to the confusion. We're going to try to cut through some of that later in the show. But here's a look at some of the headlines we're following this morning. Here's the sound of U.S. troops during day three of the offensive in Marja.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
Right next to it, on the side.
Which side? Right side, left
side. Side wall, right.
You're listening to the sound of United States Marine and Afghan units. Now they've cleared most of the city. They have most of it under control, but there are pockets of the city where fighting is still going on. The BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner is at NATO headquarters in nearby Kandahar. He says the main problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs the Taliban has hidden throughout Marja.
Taliban insurgents have planted even greater numbers than predicted, slowing the advance of U.S. forces in the area around Marja. Those insurgents that have chosen to stay and fight are believed to be concentrated in Marja. The assessment of NATO intelligence officers is that insurgent resistance to Operation Mushtarak is disjointed and in pockets. They believe the Taliban may be holding off from launching attacks for the next few days while they wait to see if NATO and its Afghan government allies are staying or leaving.
Now, the Pentagon says that the Taliban's use of IEDs has more than doubled from a year ago. And this morning, we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today, our message to them is, your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is drifting toward a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government.
Those enterprises controlled by the Revolutionary Guard, which we believe is in effect supplanting the government of Iran.
At the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak finally over. Alexander Bilodeau took home the gold in the moguls, winning the country's first ever Olympic gold on their home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stands cheering for them.
So far, the U.S. leads the medal count with six. They're followed by Germany and France. And best-selling British author Dick Francis has died at his home in the Cayman Islands. He was 89 years old. He wrote 42 novels about horse racing after ending his career as a jockey. Looking at the markets, Asian markets down, European indices are up, Wall Street markets closed for President's Day. Coming up in the show, as we said earlier, health studies often contradict each other. And if your child has autism, you may be confused by the information that's out there. We're going to try and get you straight information later this hour.
We're also following the Olympics. It's pretty amazing that that was Canada's first gold medal on its home turf, considering they've had the Olympics twice before. But we're following the Olympics and asking whether they've gotten too dangerous, too fast, or too extreme. We're looking for your takeaway at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to mytake@thetakeaway.org. More exciting, but are the Olympics too dangerous and too extreme for your taste? Let us know.
Good morning. Actually, John Hockenberry is out all this week, so we have Todd Zwillick filling in for John. And we have the latest details coming out of Afghanistan. U.S., British, and Afghan forces have begun day three of the assault on the Taliban stronghold of Marja in Helmand province in the southern part of the country. For the latest details, we turn to Jean McKenzie. She's a correspondent for the Global Post in Kabul, Afghanistan, and she's been getting news from her reporters out in the field. Jean, what are the latest details on the offensive?
Well, we're hearing that the Taliban are winding down a bit on their defense, on their resistance, although the spokesperson is saying that the Taliban will resist to the end, that they're not going to let the foreign and Afghan forces into Marja. They obviously cannot hold out for very long against a force of 15,000 troops. But they have surrounded the area with mines. We're hearing up to 70,000 IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, have been laid in and around Marja, which is a fairly limited district. It's not a large area.
We've been hearing that the NATO and Afghan forces are moving very, very slowly. Is that because they're coming up against more IEDs than they expected?
Absolutely. We heard from one doctor inside Marja that just 200 meters in front of his house, he had seen the Taliban laying 35 mines that were interconnected. So that can do quite a bit of damage to a force that encounters them. They're going to have to move very, very slowly because with a very long run-up to this operation, the Taliban have had ample time to put down their weapons, to put down the IEDs.
Also with us this morning is Jeffrey Dressler. He's an expert on Afghanistan at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses in particular on military strategy. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
I wanted you to listen to this particular clip of tape from Lieutenant Ryan Engel. He's with the Lima Company.
3-6, Lima Company. We came into the northwest area of Marja and took this intersection of the canals. It was limited resistance, much less, no real resistance, much less than was expected. But we did find several IEDs and bombs and things like that.
Why are we experiencing less resistance than expected in Marja?
Well, I actually don't think that it's a surprise to people who are familiar with the operations that the Taliban have mounted in the past. They typically do not confront a large-scale military force head-on. What they do is exactly what you're seeing. It's a lot of asymmetric hit-and-run attacks, primarily with IEDs and mines. And so this is really much, very much in character for what we've seen in the past. And I think that you know, as I heard you mention earlier, that certainly is going to account for the pace, the slow pace of the operation for the Marines and Afghan troops.
Jeffrey Dressler, 12 Afghan civilians were killed by an American rocket strike that missed its intended target yesterday. The whole purpose, the military had said, of publicizing this in advance was to, number one, get civilians to safe haven if they possibly could, and to allow the Taliban to cross over. So what does this rocket strike that killed 12 civilians, how does that hurt this offensive?
Well, I mean, there's no question that it's always a tragic event whenever innocent lives are lost. It's my understanding that what happened was it was a malfunction in the rocket technology that caused it to misfire and kind of go off target, and it struck a civilian compound. And I think the reports coming out are suggesting between 10 and 12 civilians were killed. And so, you know, obviously they've tried to do everything that they can to prevent civilian casualties, and that absolutely has been the number one concern, and I know that they'll continue to operate that way. Unfortunately, sometimes when you have that much combat power in a very small area, sometimes things like this can happen. But it's definitely going to be incumbent upon the tribal elders and the newly appointed district leaders who are going to go in shortly to explain to the population, okay, you know, here's what we're here to do. This is why we launched the operation, and we are here to bring you things that you want. And so hopefully they'll be understanding in that regard.
Jean McKenzie, have you heard any response from the, in terms of what the civilian response are to these casualties? I know that the United States has apologized to Hamid Karzai. What are the people of Afghanistan saying?
Well, of course, it's going to be a very angry reaction to this. No matter what the excuses are, you cannot expect that you're going to be able to conduct an operation of this size without civilian casualties. No matter how hard you try, accidents are going to happen. Bombs are going to land on the wrong houses, or rockets, as we see, have gone off course. But in addition to the outright civilian casualties, we've heard that up to 900 families, and that would be numbered in the thousands, 4,000 or 5,000 people, are now displaced. They're on the move. They're going to Las Cargas. They have no shelter. They have no food. This is also causing quite a negative reaction from the people of Helmand.
Jean McKenzie, this is Todd Zwillick here. What concern are you hearing from the troops if they're encountering light resistance at this point, that the Taliban have simply melted into Pakistan and will come back to fight another day when it's more advantageous for them?
I think, of course, that is a concern. They don't necessarily have to have melted into Pakistan. Much more likely, they are melting back into the population. It's very difficult to tell a Taliban from a farmer from a shopkeeper. So chances are that they will just lay down their arms. They will wait for things to calm down, and then they will start, as Jeffrey Dressler pointed out, asymmetric warfare against the troops once they have stopped the active offensive.
Jeffrey Dressler, I wanted to play for you this clip from NATO spokesman Mark Sedwill.
I can't yet say how long it will take for this military phase to get to the point where we can bring in the civilian support from the Afghan government. We hope that will happen quickly.
So we assume this offensive, as we said, is going to be slow and steady. But when it finishes, Janitor Stanley McChrystal said we're bringing in government in a box. Is that going to be the hardest part of this? Is what comes after they've secured the territory?
I think that's going to be really the marker of success here, not necessarily the military phase, but what these local governance elements, really the Afghan face that needs to be on this operation, come in and what they're able to accomplish. And so I think that we'll look to that over the coming months to see exactly how this thing's going to play out. The good news is we've done this before, even as recent as the past 6 to 9 months, and so we do have experience in that respect. So that's absolutely correct.
Jeffrey Dressler, he's an Afghanistan expert at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses on military strategy, especially in Helmand Province, which is where the Marja offensive is going on now. Jean McKenzie is a correspondent for the Global Post. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Thanks to both of you.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now.
And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
We've just been talking about Afghanistan. Well, this morning, the government there called on Taliban fighters in the city of Marja to give up their weapons. Afghan Interior Minister Mohammad Atmar appealed to the Taliban to stop fighting.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today, our message to them is your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
Meanwhile, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, says she fears Iran is moving towards becoming what she called a military dictatorship. Mrs. Clinton said the international sanctions should target Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which she said was in effect supplanting government control. She was speaking on a tour of the Middle East. Off to space now, and astronauts on board the International Space Station have finished installing a new observation deck this morning. The installation has had its hiccups. Jammed bolts and loose wiring made for a long, frustrating night of work.
Every Roman Catholic bishop in Ireland will meet with the Pope one-on-one in the Vatican today about the years of sex abuse by the Irish clergy. Irish Bishop John Duffy says the Pope has been clued in for a long time.
Even before he became Pope at all, that he had access to the documentation, that he knew exactly what was in the documentation.
And back at home, Southwest Airlines has issued an apology to Hollywood director Kevin Smith. The airline officials threw him out of a flight because he was too large to fit in a single seat. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, who watches over the uninsured and the injured? We will. And we'll continue our series, The Waiting Room, and how some people are trying to find the bright side in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for takeouts on the top stories that we're following all week. I'm Todd Zwillick, in all week for John Hockenberry, who's out. I'm here with Celeste, of course. First up, we turn to the White House, where President Obama plans to have an official meeting with the Dalai Lama in the map room in the White House. Now, in the world of diplomatic protocol, that's somehow less important than a meeting in the Oval Office. But the only problem is that a meeting with Tibet's spiritual leader is definitely going to enrage the Chinese just the same, regardless of which room of the White House it's in. And this is all at a time when the president really needs China's support. Well, here with more is Lynn Sweet. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily. She's been following the story. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Lynn, how long has this meeting been in the works? The Dalai Lama was in Washington a few months ago, right?
He was. He's been in the United States twice since Obama has been president. This visit Thursday will be his third time in the United States in the Obama presidency. The meeting has been in the works since September, when Obama sent senior advisor Valerie Jarrett over to Dalai Lama, India, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile. He's lived there since 1959, and on that September visit, she invited him to the United States.
So on the last visit, I remember the president did not meet with the Dalai Lama, and some human rights groups were upset about that. Now he is meeting with the Dalai Lama. The Chinese, of course, are outraged, but this all kind of smacks of sort of diplomatic theater. They knew this meeting was coming. Okay, China, you be outraged. We'll do our things. Let's not let anything derail. Am I reading too much into it?
Well, the timing is everything. One of the messages that the White House was sending to the Dalai Lama in September was that the meeting can take place after the president has been in China. So the China visit occurred in November. So that timeline, I think, speaks for itself. The Dalai Lama gets an invitation to the White House in September. He's in the United States in October, does not go to the White House. Then Obama goes to China in November, talks to the Chinese, explains his position, says that the relationship is can handle this, and the meeting is Thursday.
All very well choreographed so far. We'll see if the Chinese play their part later on in the week. Thank you, Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily in Washington.
Our next takeout comes from the Olympic Village in Vancouver, British Columbia, where sports writer John Branch is covering the Olympic Games for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Can you kind of bring us up to speed on what happened with the Olympics over the weekend, both the tragic and the triumphant?
Sure. A couple of the storylines. First of all, the tragic is on the death of a luge athlete from Georgia on the luge track. And as he came to the very last corner of that track, was upended and went off the track and was killed. It's the first death of an athlete at the Olympics, of an athlete during training or at the competition itself since 1964. Certainly not the way the Olympics wanted to come off. Last night, a cheerier note for the Canadians and the Vancouver Organizing Committee was the first gold medal ever won by a Canadian on Canadian soil. This is the third Olympics for the Canadians to host. And last night, an athlete named Alex Bilodeau won a gold medal in moguls. So it'll be a big celebration.
Yeah, and probably a lot of people collecting on their office pools on when that was going to happen, right?
Exactly. And that has been being watched for several days now, the first few days of the Olympics. And he now will be a name that Canadians, I think, school children will never forget.
Okay, John Branch is a sports writer for our partner, the New York Times.
Now for our next takeout, we head to the waiting room.
I've never really thought about health plan until I got sick.
And suddenly I have some health problems.
A lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one.
The healthcare reform debate has gone relatively quiet in Washington, at least for now, as the White House and Democrats try to work out a new plan and make some nods of bipartisanship to Republicans. But far away from the halls of Congress, the conversation about what's right and what's wrong with healthcare rages on. We've been dropping in on those conversations regularly thanks to a project called The Waiting Room. It's a film and a web and social media project documenting life in the waiting room of Highland Hospital, which is a county facility in Oakland, California. First, we check in with Robert Templeton, who is with his family members at the hospital.
My daughter-in-law broke her foot, and I took off of work to bring her here. She does not have health insurance. Her foot is broken, and she's still sitting there waiting. And there's another lady in a wheelchair over there who's been here since we've been here, over an hour and a half, and you can see the pain on her face, and she's not being waited on.
This project also features moments of beauty in a place where people are often experiencing misery and boredom or impatience. Here's Wanda Gorey, a housekeeper at Highland Hospital. She says faith has helped her enjoy her job. In this moment, she decided to sing to the waiting patients.
Why should I feel discouraged? And why should the shadows
You can watch videos of the waiting room and learn more about the project at thetakeaway.org. And of course, we always want to hear about your experiences with doctors and hospitals as the health reform debate rages on. That's also at thetakeaway.org. You know, Celeste, I cover this debate in Washington, and as much as it rages on, the people I cover really probably don't have a sense, a true sense of what people go through in the waiting room trying to get care for that broken leg when they don't have insurance or that child who's sick.
And I think that's part of the issue, is trying to help the people in Washington understand what it's like on the ground. Also, understanding what it's like on the ground, we're going to talk later about family, as we do every Monday. And we're going to talk about, how does your family make sense of autism when it seems like health studies contradict themselves? We have the straight facts for you later this hour. We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning long. Got off to kind of a sad start, as we talked about, when a loser died during practice on Friday. And we're looking for your takeaway. Are the Winter Olympics getting too fast? Are they too extreme? Are they trying to get audience members by being too extreme? Are they too dangerous? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to the website, thetakeaway.org.
How do you go down market in terms of age without making it so dangerous that it's bad for the athletes? You know, coming up, we're also going to talk about what to expect from the week's news. It's Monday. It's The Agenda with the New York Times and the BBC. It's in a few minutes. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry all this week. Coming up, we take a look at the week ahead in news. That's a check on the agenda in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. The battle for Marja is in day three in Afghanistan.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
NATO troops now have most of the city under control. A remaining problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs the Taliban has hidden throughout the city that makes for slow going for U.S. troops, with one report saying it takes 9 hours to clear a single mile there. And this morning, we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind. Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, tells CBS News the Marja campaign could not be seen as a turning point in the war.
We will do well militarily, but whether we can translate this into enduring security and stability gains, we won't know that for years.
So far, one U.S. Marine has been killed in the fighting.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is moving towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government. And the International Space Station has a new addition, a $27 million observation deck. Astronauts successfully attached it after a long night spent in spacewalks. Let's check on the markets. Asian markets are down, but European indices are up. Wall Street markets are closed for the President's Day holiday today. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Issues that are of mutual interest.
Criminal acts as opposed to acts of war.
Working through questions.
Carrying forward this important work.
It's Monday morning, and that means it's time to check out what's on for the week ahead. It's The Agenda. We do it every Monday. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues her trip in the Middle East this week. She spoke today at the U.S. Islamic World Forum and had very strong words for the Iranian government. She says that they've been becoming a military dictatorship. Listen to this.
I fear that the rise of influence and power by the Revolutionary Guard poses a very direct threat to everyone.
Secretary of State also threatened greater costs to the Iranian regime if it does not comply with nuclear inspections and U.S. desires for their nuclear program. To discuss this and other items on our agenda, we were joined earlier this morning by Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. We started by asking Marcus if the statements by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were meant to isolate Iran, to strengthen ties with the rest of the Muslim world, or some combination of both?
It's actually both. It's interesting that what she really is at risk of this week, and it's not just the Secretary of State who's at risk, but even the President as he meets with the Dalai Lama, and we'll talk about later on, the administration is at risk this week of kind of highlighting American impotence in the world. And the fact that even though it's been a year since President Obama came to office with great hopes for foreign policy, we actually have not seen a great deal of progress on any of these really important fronts. And even in Afghanistan, we're seeing this is the most serious offensive we've ever had in Afghanistan. Afghanistan this week in 8 years of war. So this, too, is a test of the administration's ability to change facts on the ground in a way that the previous administration never did. And that's what we're going to see in the Middle East this week with Secretary of State Clinton. The fact is, Iran, it's a military dictatorship, as she's declared. Well, what are we going to do about that? And it's not clear we can do a whole lot. When she talks about the cost, greater cost, she's talking about an increased sanctions. And it's not even clear we can get that. And so that's the enjeu here is really the administration look a little stronger and a little more effective than they have in the past.
Rob Watson of the BBC, Marcus Mabry suggests that the time is ripe for some tough talk from the administration. It seems that Secretary Clinton talking about a military dictatorship in Iran is tailor-made for the Saudis, who are traditional enemies of the Iranians.
Absolutely, although I'm going to disappoint everyone by rather boringly agreeing with Marcus 100%.
Oh, hey, why not?
This does really sort of show up the impotence, if you like, or potentially the impotence. But I guess I'd want to see it as another way. You know, I remember there were lots of people around, certainly around Europe and some in the Middle East, who thought, phewie, thank goodness George W. Bush has gone. Now we can get on with solving some of these dreadful problems. And you get to see that the real issue that's out there is not so much who's in the White House, but just that there are an awful lot of problems that are very, very difficult to deal with, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or whoever you are. And this really reinforces it, and specifically on Saudi Arabia. Look, lots of Iran's neighbors realize that it's a threat. Lots of them were just dying for the nuclear issue to go away. But when you actually confront them and say, what are you going to do about it? Well, then you get the difficulties.
Rob Watson of the BBC, you mentioned the White House, and I want to move on to China, if we could, and the international sort of reaction to the president meeting with the Dalai Lama, specifically the Chinese. Now, this visit, the president going to be meeting with the Dalai Lama in the White House later this week, has been planned for a long time. Of course, the Chinese outrage is mounting right on cue. It's hard to imagine that this is a surprise for anyone. So how should we interpret the president's meeting with the Dalai Lama and the Chinese outrage over said meeting on the international stage?
Well, as you say, it's pretty much according to script, isn't it? Look, in international terms, the way countries like Britain and others in the European Union see it, that they're cutting Obama some slack here because they think, okay, you know, he's tried what everyone wanted him to do. Let's try being a bit nice to China. Let's try being a bit nice to North Korea and Iran. And let's try pressing the reset button with Russia. The very fact that he's tried those things and doesn't seem to have got a huge amount to date out of it means that everyone's right back on the script. Okay, well, you've got to see the Dalai Lama. You've got to do other things. You've got to be tough on Iran.
All right. Well, let's listen to Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about this very issue earlier this week.
We can agree on issues that are of mutual interest, but we also have a mature enough relationship that we know that two countries on this planet are not always going to agree on everything, and we'll have those disagreements.
Okay, Marcus Mabry, the dynamic of poking China with the stick a little bit when you have to over the Dalai Lama is clear. But what does the president have to gain, do you think, from holding this meeting? Why does he feel he has to do it?
Well, he has to do it because he has to show that the United States still cares, although we care most of all, and it's increasingly clear in our relationship with China about our economic relationship with China, which is a mutually assured destruction, some would say, but certainly a mutually beneficial relationship. They take our debt when no one else. They take it in great quantities, and we take their product. They're still export-dependent economy. We take their product. So that's the most important thing about the relationship between these two countries. At the same time, the president of the United States, especially a Democratic president, especially given how much the Republican president before him did this, must underline how much the United States continues to care about the rights of minorities and religious minorities.
He has a political debate that demands this.
Absolutely. There's no other choice. Again, the last administration did so much in this regard, criticizing China on these issues, that he can't do any less.
All right, Marcus Mabry in the New York Times, I have to get your take on this little battle that's going, the battle of the vice presidents, Dick Cheney and the current vice president, Joe Biden, going at each other on the Sunday shows on terrorism. Let's give Dick Cheney his say first.
It's the mindset that concerns me, John. I think it's very important to go back and keep in mind the distinction between handling these events as criminal acts, which is the way we did before 9/11, and then looking at 9/11 and saying this is not a criminal act, not when you destroy 16 acres of Manhattan, kill 3,000 Americans, blow a big hole in the Pentagon. That's an act of war.
All right. Now, the vice president shot back and said that Dick Cheney's trying to be entitled to his own facts.
Dick Cheney's a fine fella, but he is not entitled to rewrite history without it being challenged. I don't know where he has been. Where was he the last 4 years, the last administration?
That was Vice President Joe Biden on NBC's Meet the Press responding to former Vice President Dick Cheney, who appeared on ABC's This Week. What do you make of that battle, Marcus?
Well, this is exactly the same criticism that the Republicans made against John Kerry when he was running against George W. Bush. The Democrats see it as a legal battle. The Republicans see it as an act of war. There's not a whole lot to it other than the politics and the rhetoric that Cheney's pursuing, but the Republicans have had some success with it in the past.
That was Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Rob Watson, BBC correspondent, who joined us from Bush House in London. Coming up, we talk about family life every Monday. Now, how do you and your family make sense of autism when it seems like health studies contradict themselves and autism itself is so very complicated? We talk about that issue coming up later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Investigators are looking into the past of a biology professor accused of killing three of her colleagues at the University of Alabama on Friday. Amy Bishop was charged on Saturday with the shootings. It's now being reported that Bishop may also have murdered her brother 24 years ago in a shooting at their home outside Boston. And she was a suspect in a mail bombing of a Harvard Medical School professor in 1993. We're joined now by New York Times reporter Shyla Dewan. She's covering the story from Huntsville, Alabama. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So can you give us more details about what they've discovered in terms of the shooting of both her brother, in which he was killed in their home with a shotgun, and this mail bombing of a Harvard Medical School professor?
Sure. I mean, new details keep coming out, and you just don't know whether this woman was incredibly unlucky or whether she has a violent history. In 1986, a shotgun went off in her house, killing her brother. She had the shotgun, but it's not clear whether she and her brother were arguing. As some of the police who were there at the time now say, or if it was purely accidental, and she was asking for help with the shotgun, which is what the police reports and the district attorney's investigation say.
Well, they had details in which they said she then shot off the shotgun again and then went running down the street and threatened a driver of a car to let her into the car with the gun.
That's right, but that's one story.
That's alleged.
But that story, so far, we don't know if there's any records that show that chain of events happening, because the records that have been released so far do not indicate
some of the cases missing. Are there any inklings that they may reopen the case of the death of her brother, Seth Bishop?
I think what they're doing first is they're trying to see if they can find that earlier police report that is missing.
The original police report.
And then they're going to go from there.
So what about this mail bombing of the Harvard Medical School professor in 1993?
Well, we just learned yesterday that she and her husband were questioned in that case. The Boston Globe reported that she was a significant suspect in the case, that authorities knew that she had killed her brother, and they were worried because she apparently had some cause to be concerned that this doctor was going to give her a bad evaluation. She was also considered strange or weird by her colleagues there at the hospital, and so the police questioned her, but it's important to say again that no one was ever charged in the case.
And we've gotten a little bit more of a complete ideas on what possible motivation she may have had in the shootings on Friday. Do we know what might have triggered it?
Well, we got clarification yesterday from her husband that her tenure decision was denied by the university, that she won her appeal, and then the university, which can do this, denied her again.
Okay, so it could have been the possibility that she was reaching the end of her 6 years at the university and therefore was going to lose her job.
That's right.
Shyla Dewan is a reporter with the New York Times. She is covering the story of the shootings that happened on Friday. She's covering that from Huntsville, Alabama. A biology professor at the University of Alabama opened fire at a faculty meeting at the university there and has killed three of her colleagues. Allegedly, she has been charged with the shooting. She was charged on Saturday. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm joined by Todd Zwillick this morning, who's filling in for John Hockenberry this week. When health studies contradict each other, who do you believe? How do you know what to believe when it comes down to science and medical issues? We're going to focus on autism today and how to separate fact from fiction. It's coming up in a minute. First, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. As we've been talking about all morning long, today is the third day of the major military offensive in the city of Marja in Afghanistan. Latest reports from our partner, the BBC, say the U.S. advance is being slowed down by Taliban snipers and by the discovery of far more IEDs or improvised explosive devices than expected. There's been a major train crash in Belgium today. The Associated Press says at least 25 people are known to have been killed in the rush hour collision of two commuter trains in Brussels. There are reports one of the trains went through a red light.
At the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak finally ended. Alexander Bilodeau took home gold in the moguls, winning Canada's first ever Olympic gold on their home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stands here for them.
Okay, he's confident. So far, the U.S. leads the medal count with six, followed by Germany and then France.
Today in international business, ticket prices for transatlantic flights could be affected by a newly approved alliance between American Airlines, British Airways, and Iberia Airlines. The U.S. Department of Transportation has given the One World Alliance antitrust immunity. For details on this, we spoke earlier this morning with BBC business reporter Rodney Smith. He told us how the deal stands and how it would affect ticket prices on something like a one-way flight from New York to London.
Well, first of all, the deal's quite a long way away yet. It's not happened, and the Europeans still have to decide if they're going to go ahead with this. But you're quite right. The whole point really is about the effect that it has on people flying between New York-London or New York-Paris or whatever, from between the States and between Europe. And at the moment, it's unlikely to have an impact. But over time, say the airlines, there will be economies of scale which will allow costs to come down. But critics say, of course, that that's all very well, but there could have been nine airlines here instead of what we're seeing now, which is essentially three alliances, and that means the competition is less, and so prices could be higher.
So they've given this One World Alliance antitrust immunity. Is this something that consumers should be outraged about?
They didn't give antitrust immunity 10 years ago when it was first applied for, so we have to wonder what happened in the interim. They've required that BA give up some of the these very lucrative airline slots at Heathrow. That's right, British Airways. They're having to give up four slots. This is a very technical issue, and you have to wonder what sort of pressure was put on the regulators that they decided to let this come through like this.
Okay, Rodney Smith is the business reporter for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from London. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
New studies are released and retracted all the time on what causes autistic spectrum disorder and what quote-unquote cures it. For example, in the last 2 weeks, the British medical journal The Lancet retracted the frequently cited Wakefield study from 1998, which linked MMR vaccine, that's measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, to autism. Now, just a few days later, the journal Autism Research published a study saying that advanced maternal and paternal age, that's the age of mom and dad, is a risk factor for autism. So what's true and what isn't? We want to spend a little time trying to get down into the data on autism. To make it a little simpler, we want to give you a little bit of a crib sheet here on what we know about autism and what we don't know. Dr. Perry Klass and Dr. Eileen Costello are both pediatricians and co-authors of Quirky Kids. Dr. Klass is here in the studio with me. Dr. Klass, autistic spectrum disorder is sort of the catch-all phrase, and the term autism is really hard to understand because it's not just one thing. It may not even be just five things. Can you help us understand exactly what is autism in a way that isn't too overwhelming to even understand for us?
Well, it's a complicated term, it's a complicated spectrum, and I think one of the things that you bring up in what you said initially is just our understanding that it is a spectrum, that it's not one very specific disorder, that it's a whole spectrum of behaviors and levels of function. That's kind of new. That wasn't around when wasn't around when I was in medical school, let alone when I was a child.
Characterized by what? A couple of instances of the behaviors or the problems that identify this.
There is a communication issue, both a social communication issue in terms of understanding other people's social cues and social signals. There can be very specific communication considerations in terms of how children use speech and language and how language develops. There is a whole range of issues then that come up around repetitive acts and very special interests and even obsessional interests. There's an interplay of these different traits that mark people on the autism spectrum. I just want to comment on one other thing before you say. You say new studies are introduced and retracted all the time. In fact, that retraction that you mentioned by The Lancet was a pretty unusual event and probably has something to do with why we're having this conversation.
Probably does. Well, all of these behaviors and these difficulties that kids have that you're describing, as complicated as they are, all translate to really difficult parenting. Or they can, because these kids can be difficult to parent. Dr. Costello, I want to bring you in. I have a list in front of me of a lot of causes or supposed causes of autism. We've heard all of these, but they're really complicated. And I thought you might go down the list and just help us understand how much of this is true. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. Vaccines. They're definitely off the table as a cause now?
Yes.
Off the table.
And that is a wonderful thing. As a primary care pediatrician, I think the Wakefield study that Dr. Klass was just referring to really caused a lot of fear and panic around the world and caused a lot of parents to have anxiety about immunizing their children. And it's a real blessing that the paper was retracted, because I think that research dollars were diverted in order to disprove that theory that could have been used for more important things.
Okay, let's get down the list here a little bit. Vaccines off the table. Environmental factors, heavy metals like lead and mercury.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think the mercury question is also a vaccine question, because I think when the MMR vaccine came off the table, the idea that something in vaccines must be causing this problem gained some strength. And I think we're pretty clear that it's certainly not the mercury-based preservatives in vaccines. And even the children who are exposed to very high levels of mercury don't actually manifest autistic symptoms.
Okay,
I think we're pretty sure that's not the problem either.
Okay, I don't want to keep you too short, but we have a long list and there's so many questions about this. Viruses that can affect pregnant women, like influenza and herpes, they have a role?
There is some data to suggest that viral infections in pregnancy can increase your rates of developmental disorders, including autism.
Now, we had this study last week that we mentioned, age of mom and dad, older age increases your risk. What do we know about that?
Yes, I think that theory's been around for a long time, and there is growing data that advanced parental age is a risk factor.
Okay, that it could be. Dr. Klass, we've talked about some of the causes of autism. What about cures, or so-called cures? We've heard about gluten-free and dairy-free diets. A lot of this stuff seems to be trial and error.
A lot of this stuff is trial and error, and when you talk about the burdens that autism places on parents, some of these more extreme diets place an even greater burden on parents. Obviously, different things parents feel help with different children. The idea of a cure for autism is not really something we talk about. We talk about this as whether the child gets relief or help with the things that get in the way, with the things that make that child's life difficult. And there's no evidence around those diets, especially the more extreme diets.
So you're talking about behavioral help and help with the difficulties of behavior and parenting, not necessarily high-dose vitamins or things like chelation therapy, which is where they go in and try to suck the lead and the mercury out.
And which is actually dangerous and
which
has been known to kill a child. No, we're talking
oxygen chambers and things like that.
I think the really basic message, and I bet Dr. Costello would agree with me about this, is that the behavioral therapies, and especially when you start them early, the more intense behavioral therapies are showing up as really effective. And for that, there really are data. And therefore, that urge to get children looked at and diagnosed earlier rather than later and get them help early is where a lot of our attention and effort should be going.
All right. So we're talking about paying attention to behavior and helping with the difficult behaviors of autism rather than some chemical interventions. That's Dr. Perry Klass, primary care pediatrician and Science Times writer. And we're also joined by Dr. Eileen Costello, primary care pediatrician and co-author of Quirky Kids. And we'll have more info for you on the website, where we explain the 5 myths about autism. That's at thetakeaway.org.
You can also follow more of our stories all week long with our podcast. You can listen on demand and even get a preview of the next day's show. That's all on our website, thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about dogs, actually, this week, because the Westminster Dog Show begins today. One of the things we're discussing today is whether or not we're too obsessed with our pets and whether that's healthy for both us and our dogs. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you think? Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. That's also the website is where you can post a photo of your dog. You have an hour left until 10 a.m. Eastern to get a picture of your dog up on thetakeaway.org, because we're going to have our own little dog show, including Best in Show and some other prizes. They're all going to go to my beagle, of course.
Right.
Give us your picture at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway. The Olympic Games are filled with pageantry and grace and tradition. But lately, the games seem less like this and more like this. Higher, faster, further is becoming just faster, faster, faster. Is the Olympics push towards extreme sports just making them extremely dangerous? Strap yourself in. This is not the curling preliminaries. It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm in for John Hockenberry all this week, and I'm here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. It's Monday, February 15th, President's Day, and The Takeaway, you know, is, to me, Celeste, is the Olympics push for faster, faster, faster to get those younger viewers. Kind of like skateboarding on the street. It's just going to make it more dangerous.
And what's with the media coverage that keeps showing over and over the accident in which this athlete died? And I don't like it. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. In Afghanistan, NATO troops now have most of the city of Marja under control. There are reports a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to the Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind and are fighting in pockets. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Jean McKenzie, correspondent for the Global Post in Kabul. She told us the main problem is that the Taliban scattered bombs throughout the city.
We're hearing up to 70,000 IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, have been laid in and around Marja.
U.S. and Afghan troops are also being held up by sniper fire. In other news, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is moving towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government.
I fear that the rise of influence and power by the Revolutionary Guard poses a very direct threat to everyone.
Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, tells CBS News he agrees.
Secretary of State is right. It's no longer a theocracy. It's a thugocracy run by these guys with clubs and worse.
Later today, Secretary Clinton heads to Saudi Arabia, where she's expected to press for more international pressure to impose sanctions on Iran.
In Haiti, U.S. military is scaling back its aid. About 13,000 troops now remain on or near the island, down from 20,000 2 weeks ago. And at the Winter Olympics, officials lowered the men's start in the luge competition down to the ladies' ramp after Friday's fatal accident on the track. U.S. luger Tony Benshoof, who missed out on medaling, says it could have been different. It would have been a different story, rather, if he'd been allowed to start from the top of the course.
If we were going from the top of the track, it would be a completely different outcome.
For more now, we're joined by Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Jason, good morning.
Good morning.
Jason, there's a turn to more extreme sports. The luge is getting faster. We have board cross, several snowboarders on the course at one time, skiers on the course all at one time. It seems to be getting more dangerous. Have the Olympic organizers acknowledged a reason for this? Are they just trying to attract younger members? What's the cause of all this extreme sports in the games now?
Well, several things are conspiring to make the Winter Olympics more dangerous on a few levels. Olympic officials do acknowledge that they tried to update the schedule for the Winter Games to make them appeal to a broader audience, i.e., younger demographic. But a few other factors that are in play here. One is technology. The technology in almost every sport is allowing these athletes to push the envelope more and more. And the athletes themselves have a much more modern mindset in these things. It's not the Winter Olympics that our father told us about.
All right, Jason Stallman, stay with us. We'll have more on the Olympics in a minute.
And best-selling British author Dick Francis has died at the age of 89. He wrote 42 novels about horse racing after he ended his successful career as a jockey. In the markets, Asian markets are down, European indices are up. Wall Street markets close today for the President's Day holiday. Coming up, the Westminster Dog Show begins in New York today, and we're going to talk about our obsession with our dogs. Is it good for them? Is it good for us? That's later this hour.
And in just a few minutes, we go back to the Olympics. Are Olympic sports getting more dangerous? Too extreme? 8778-MY-TAKE. Post to our website, thetakeaway.org, and that conversation is coming up. Good morning. Todd Zwillick here. I'm filling in for John Hockenberry all this week while he's off. Of course, I'm here with Celeste. You've been watching the Olympic Games?
I watched the ice hockey, the women's victory over the Chinese
team. Oh, yeah, 12-1.
Yeah.
I was surprised China got a goal, actually, to be honest.
But. Were you? It was better that they got at least one. But other than that, I'm generally an Olympics highlights watcher.
Just
I watch
the highlights.
Reel.
Now, what about the extreme sports? Not only luge, but like
I'm not
four-man
an extreme.
Skiing.
I'm a mom. I can't watch extreme sports without thinking that someone's going to get hurt.
Well, that's sort of the issue that they're dealing with in Vancouver right now. In British Columbia, Vancouver, of course, the host of the 2010 Games, has pulled out all the stops for this year's Games, and they spent about $100 million to construct newer and bigger and, at this point, faster courses for the world's finest athletes. And faster is sort of the point here. Bigger is not always better. Last week, U.S. Slider Erin Hamlin was asked to share her thoughts about Whistler's new luge track, thought to be one of the fastest in the world.
We all are good enough sliders, and we have the skills to make it down, so we wouldn't be here if we didn't. And it's a lot of fun. You know, the reason we do this sport is to go fast.
But that was before tragedy struck. Since the death of Georgian slider Nordar Kumarakashvili last Friday, the International Olympic Committee took several steps to slow down the course. But that's not the only sport where speed is a double-edged sword. It's dangerous, but also attractive, and part of a decades-long trend towards speedier and more dangerous winter sports. And in fact, it's all about viewers. It has to be. Jason Stallman is the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. He joins us. He's back with us from Vancouver. Jason, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Jason, we all have heard about the luge accident. We should jump off there because it seems to be the epitome of faster and more dangerous sports. Even though sliding isn't new, it reached new heights of dangerousness. We've all heard about the Georgian slider who lost his life, unfortunately. But can you update us on like the mechanics, the kinetics of what went wrong, why this athlete unfortunately and tragically lost his life?
Sure. The luge accident really does touch on so many issues that are at play here. You mentioned Vancouver organizers spending $100 million for the facilities. That's $100 million-plus alone for the Whistler Sliding Center, where bobsled, luge, and the skeleton competition is being held. And from the day it opened, the athletes and coaches and officials involved have noted how dangerously fast the track was. They expected the sliders and luge specifically to attain speeds of about 140 kilometers an hour. They were about 10 kilometers an hour on average beyond that. And there was a lot of voice of concern over the past couple of years, a lot of crashes on that track. They didn't rein it in, and here's where we stand.
Okay, now the international committees, including the International Luge Federation, was defending the track. Listen to Sven Romstad. He's the Secretary General of the Luge Federation.
This track has been operational for over two years. And I think we've had somewhat about 5,000 plus runs in the track. And if you look upon the overall, for lack of a better word, the crash ratio, it is on par with other tracks.
Now, Jason Stallman of the New York Times, he's saying the crash ratio, for lack of a better term, is right where you'd expect it to be. But that's not what you're seeing.
Well, keep in mind that Canada had some control over who would use the track in training. Canadian sliders had, on average, about 250 runs per athlete before the Olympics at the Whistler Sliding Center. The Georgian athlete who died, I believe, had 25 runs before his fatal accident. So to take the total number and tally the crashes, it seems slightly misleading.
Okay, so luge is a traditional sport, maybe more dangerous because of a more dangerous track possibly this year. But there are some new sports that fit into the extreme category. We got to go through them more quickly because it seems less like traditional Olympics and more like the X Games. You've got certainly snowboarding and snowcross, which is, I think, four or possibly more snowboarders on the course at the same time. They do the same thing in downhill skiing with several skiers on the course. It sounds exciting, but it is exciting, but it also seems like a recipe for broken legs.
That's exactly what it is. It sounds exciting. To us, it seems like a bunch of young kids out on a ski slope saying, "Hey, snowboarding's pretty cool. And we go one at a time. How about we all go at once and see what chaos ensues?"
And that sounds sort of like the point. Exactly what you just described is to get those 17-year-olds who think it's darn cool to start watching the Olympics, I suppose.
Sure. that's what Olympic officials are faced with. Maybe they have a broader audience at this point, but they've also invited danger to a certain extent. The luge death, it's extremely rare to have an accident of that magnitude on a sliding track, but just in the past couple of years in snowboard cross and skier cross, there have been more fatalities and there have been far more injuries. It gets really ugly in these sports, and the conditions at Cypress Mountain where these are being held for the Vancouver Olympics, they're not very good conditions right now because of the weather and the snow quality. So we were out talking to the skier cross athletes yesterday, and they were forecasting some doom there.
And one of your stories in the Times this morning saying that the conditions might even be dangerous for spectators because the fake snow is too deep for them to walk in. Jason Stallman from the Times, I want to ask you this. There's a huge marketing angle for this. I'm trying, as we mentioned, to get younger audiences to watch the Olympics, but it seems like the Olympics is of two minds. The other big sport that gets all of the airplay in the United States is figure skating, which seems to be marketed mostly towards women. There's a lot of fitness commercials and yogurt commercials during skating. And then you whipsaw to extreme X-sports snow, X-factor snowboarding, for lack of a better term. Is the Olympics sort of struggling to find its marketing footing here?
I think just like any other big business, it's doing whatever it can to appeal to as many people as possible. Perhaps this is the first time at the international scene it's having to suffer some of the consequences of that on the danger side.
Some of the consequences. But there have always been, I guess, a lot of the injuries we've always seen in dangerous sports like hockey. And frankly, figure skating is not safe. There's tons of injuries in figure skating. They tend not to be visible.
Right. They're not the violent kind.
Right. So what concerns have you heard from the athletes who are in things like board cross? Now, they're probably in it because they want to compete in this sport and they overcome the fear in order to win a medal. Are there any legitimate fears of injury? Do they think that somehow the way Vancouver is handling their event isn't quite safe for them?
No, we haven't heard any athletes in the board sports complain about that. And you're right, it's going to be rare to find an athlete who will admit to being fearful or worried about the conditions. But there have been some complaints from the athletes in the sliding sports about their access to the Whistler Sliding Center in advance of the Winter Games.
And faster, of course, and without being able to practice, can wind up being dangerous, just as we saw earlier this week. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times, thanks for joining us from out west in B.C. You can follow our Olympics coverage all this week on The Takeaway.
Hey, you want that to go?
For our first takeout this morning, return to Afghanistan. 15,000 NATO and Afghan troops are in the third day of an assault in the town of Marja in the southern portion of Afghanistan. And we're wondering, what do Afghan civilians think of Operation Mushtarak? That means together in the local Dari language. We were joined earlier this morning by Imal Pasarli, an editor at the BBC's Pashto service, which broadcasts inside Afghanistan. And I asked him about the significance of calling the operation by a non-English name.
It might be significant on paper, but in practice and also for the local people, it doesn't mean anything because normally local people are just calling any operation as operation rather than calling them by name.
So they don't make any distinction between this offensive in Marja than they have from any of the others?
Definitely not. And as far as the Mushtarak bit or the togetherness bit is concerned, when we speak to local people in Marja area of Helmand, all they're worried about is that whether after the operation there will be foreign and Afghan troops there or they will just leave like before and it will be back to square one.
Are they cynical about calling this the operation together?
No, I mean, as I said, people are not worried about the titles of operations. Ordinary people in Helmand, all they are seeing in the past 8 years are operations after operations, military operation after military operation. And in the past, what happened is that after a week or 2 week operation, a lot of civilian casualties, a lot of other damages, and then the foreign troops with the Afghan troops, they left the area back and the Taliban went back to the area and it went to square one. So this is the more important issue for the local people rather than what the operation might be called.
Amal Pasarli is the editor at the BBC's Pashto Service.
All right, now a money takeout from Wall Street. Markets are closed today for the President's Day holiday, but there's still some money news now from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Last week, we discussed the trouble that European economies were facing. Well, it turns out that after a little bit of investigating, that the same shady Wall Street tactics that pushed our economy into the subprime mortgage crisis may have contributed to the economic woes overseas as well. Louise, good morning.
Good morning.
So you had a front page story in the Times yesterday, Sunday. You trace Greece's economic problems back to the 90s and a desire to get into the Eurozone, the European Economic Cooperative. Go from there.
So there were very strict rules for countries to get in. If you remember, there were several shifts of countries getting in. They didn't all enter at once. Because at the root, Europe has economies that are of varying strength. They're not all that strong. Some are stronger than others. Greece was one of the weaker economies. They had to meet the rule that you could not have your deficit larger than 3% of your gross domestic product. And so what Greece did, as well as other countries like Italy, is they worked with Wall Street on these complicated derivatives transactions that allowed them to borrow money, making themselves look better than they were, but the money they borrowed did not show up on their books as a loan. It showed up as a derivative. And so it was kind of a backdoor way to meet these EU rules.
And I might call that a shell game. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, that's a loaded term because this was legal.
Okay.
Everything they did was legal. They used derivatives. They used off-balance sheet vehicles. You know, and certainly it's hard to say that you can blame Wall Street because these Greek government officials and Italian government officials wanted these products. They sought them out. At its root, their economies are weak. They've overspent. But Wall Street certainly enabled this. If they, you know, they didn't force it, but they certainly enabled it. We talked about a Goldman Sachs deal with Greece in 2001 where they were able to hide a lot of the deficit, and Greece continues to pay money into that. It's been transferred to a special purpose vehicle now. Goldman's not involved. But Goldman went back to Greece as recently as this past fall in November and said, oh, you're in trouble again. You know, we can help you with some new financing vehicle that will lend to you pushing your problems off. It's kind of like homeowners who took money out of their house through home equity lines. That's very much what Greece did with these banking deals. They sold a lot of their future revenues, like their lottery revenues, and they did that to raise money now and look better than they really are.
All right, Louise Story of the New York Times. It looks like Wall Street may not have learned its lesson after helping Greece finance its debt.
For our last takeout, let's go to California. The Hollywood sign is covered up with a sheet. The sheet says Save the Peak, and joining us now is Sam Hodder, who's the California State Director for the Trust for Public Land. Sam, why has your organization covered up the Hollywood sign with a sheet that says Save the Peak?
So to call attention to a conservation opportunity that is truly once in a lifetime. The Trust for Public Land has been working to conserve natural spaces and improve parks and playgrounds, particularly in urban areas, for 37 years, and we've been doing so in Los Angeles in particular. And in working with the City of Los Angeles, we have secured an opportunity to acquire a really remarkable property. 138-acre Cahuenga Peak property is right in the heart of the city and includes an 1,800-foot peak and a ridgeline that extends three quarters of a mile right in the heart of the city, and it also forms the natural backdrop for the Hollywood sign. Now, that property was first bought by Howard Hughes in the 1940s for his then-girlfriend Ginger Rogers. He wanted to build her a spectacular Hollywood mansion. Well, the relationship ended and the house was never built, but the property stayed in his estate for a couple of generations and was sold finally in 2002 to some developers from Chicago who intended to build four mega mansions along the ridgeline and right behind the Hollywood sign.
And you have the opportunity now to pay $12.5 million to acquire it, Sam Hodder. Sounds like you have $7 million right now, still raising funds in order to pick up that piece of land. Sam Hodder is the California State Director for the Trust for Public Land. You know, it turns out there's more than one way to fight illegal immigration. One way to stop the tide of illegal immigrants is to have a really, really bad recession. Almost 1 million illegals have left the country since 2008, or at least that's how much illegal immigration has dropped in the last year or so. We're going to find out why in just a few minutes.
Coming up, there are nearly somewhere between 600,000 and a million illegal immigrants fewer today than there were in 2008. Why? Turns out it's for the same reason many of us have been struggling, the recession. We're going to talk about that more in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. The sounds this morning from the Afghan town of Marja.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
U.S. Marine and Afghan units are pressing deeper into the city, with most of the area targeted now under NATO control. Brigadier General Larry Nicholson says the main problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs that the Taliban has hidden throughout the city.
We've been surprised by the amount of IEDs we found. There has been no shortage of IEDs, probably even more than we thought.
And this morning we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to the Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today our message to them is your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
One U.S. soldier has been killed in the fighting so far.
Staying overseas, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had these strong words for Iran this morning.
We see that the government of Iran, the supreme leader, the president, the parliament, is being supplanted, and that Iran is moving toward a military dictatorship.
Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government. And at the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak has finally ended. Alexander Bilodeau took home the gold last night in moguls, winning Canada's first ever Olympic gold on its home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stands here for them.
So far, the U.S. Leads the medal count with six, followed by Germany and then France. Now let's check on the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Wall Street markets are closed today for the President's Day holidays. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The debate over illegal immigration has long been fueled by the argument that people are here illegally and they're taking jobs from American citizens. But with the economic recession, it turns out even illegal immigrants are having trouble finding work. According to new data, the number of illegal immigrants has dropped by nearly a million since 2008. That is clearly the largest drop since we've been keeping records. We're joined now by Mark Rosenblum. He's a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute. Also with us, Victor Manuel Ramos, an immigration reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Florida is actually one of the states that has the largest decline in illegal immigrants. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Mark, how much can we trust these numbers? I mean, illegal immigration it's difficult to count illegal immigrants in the first place. So how do we know it's really on the decline?
Well, I think we want to be a little careful about putting an exact point estimate on how much it's fallen. The DHS report that I think you're...
That's Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. That you're commenting on has the drop going from 11.6 million in 2008 to 10.8 million in 2009, so about 800,000. The Pew Hispanic Center, which is the other, you know, real good reliable source on this, puts the 2008 number a little bit higher, and our analysis of their methodology has the 2009 number at 11.3 million. So there's clearly, you know, the number clearly appears to be a bit lower, but
We know it's dropped by a significant amount.
Yes.
So, Victor, your state, Florida, has seen one of the largest declines. You're in the Orlando area. Have you noticed a decrease in the immigrant population there?
Yeah, I think, the numbers just confirm that trend. We have started noticing some decline as early as 2007 because we had a significant immigrant population that had been growing, had become very visible, confident about its chances of staying here. And in 2007, with the slowdown in construction, which to a large extent started here in Florida and a couple other states, many of them found themselves without jobs and considering their options.
Well, that's exactly what Ana Luisa Trevino says. She's a community organizer with the Farm Worker Association of Florida. Here's what she has to say.
They cannot find a job. They don't have money to pay the rent. They don't have money to put food on the table. So it's very difficult for the community.
So, Mark, is it because of the recession? Have we spoken with illegal immigrants who say that they're having trouble affording their to pay for rent and food and that they can't find work?
I think the recession is definitely the primary factor driving these numbers. The other thing to keep in mind is that there's two different things going on. One is that there's definitely fewer unauthorized immigrants coming to the United States. So we see, you can look at the Mexican data and see that traditional seasonal patterns in when people come and how many people come show that fewer people are initiating new unauthorized immigration to the U.S. There's a second question about whether existing unauthorized immigrants are going home, and there's much less evidence to show that. I mean, you've always had a bit of seasonal back and forth, and what the data seem to show is that there's a lot fewer people coming, but about the same number of people going home.
Victor, I wanted you to listen to this other comment that Ana Luisa Trevino had to say.
You go to the business, you go to the malls, and, you see all these stores closing. There are areas that the houses or trailer parks are empty, like ghost towns.
So this is often something many people don't think about, but illegal immigrants are a driving force in some local economies. And what's more, they send home generally a lot of money to their native countries. Is this causing a problem in Florida?
Yeah, I think it adds to the situation of neighborhoods where people are abandoning their homes and stores that are failing. And you can notice this more in areas that are close to agricultural towns, areas where you had construction workers moving in, where, I've gone there to report on the trend and noticed that the plazas were empty, that, for example, went to a party supply store a couple of years back, and they had not sold any merchandise. You could see all the piñatas and party supplies just there in the store, and the clerk told me, well, I had sold $20 today, so I'm thinking of closing the store. So it has an effect, a ripple effect, in the surrounding communities, and particularly among businesses that are that cater to those immigrants and are often owned by immigrants who came before them.
So, Mark, this has to have an effect on the debate over illegal immigration in Washington, D.C. And I'm wondering, does this make the push to get, legal residency for some of these immigrants, does it make it a better case for it? Or is it going to be that because illegal immigration is supposedly dropping, does that mean they're not going to address the issue?
Right. Well, you're still talking about a very large unauthorized population of about 11 million. So, the problem remains in place. I think that there will be some advocates for an enforcement-only solution for not doing legalization who will cite these numbers as evidence that enforcement is working and we should, continue to do enforcement and let the problem solve itself that way. But I think, when you look at what we know about the numbers, and especially when you look at what we know about the family structure of unauthorized immigrants, the majority of unauthorized immigrants are in families. They have children. They're married and with children in the U.S., and we really don't see any evidence that those unauthorized immigrants are going home. So I think that the pressure to do a legalization from those communities and from the supporters of comprehensive reform will remain pretty intense.
But if one of the causes of this drop in illegal immigration is the recession, that would argue the fact that once the economy bounces back, we'll see them go right back up to the numbers where they were before.
Right. Unauthorized immigrants are sort of the first fired and the first hired. So, I think that as the economy recovers, we'll expect that those numbers will begin to increase again, and the demand for coming up with real policy solutions that create legal avenues will be back.
Mark Rosenblum is a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, and Victor Manuel Ramos is an immigration reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Coming up, the Westminster's Dog Show starts in New York today. We're going to talk about the obsession with pooches. Is your dog a pampered pooch? Is it healthy for you? Is it healthy for your spouse, your kids? Is it healthy for the dog? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week. Vancouver, British Columbia. Not enough time in the spotlight, I guess. Not only hosting the 2010 Games, of course, but has also come in on top in a global survey of livability. Vancouver, the world's most livable city. That's according to a new survey that's out assessing living conditions in 140 cities around the world. A rating of relative comfort is assigned across five broad categories: stability and healthcare, culture and the environment, education and infrastructure. John Copestake is the editor of this global livability report, which he conducted with The Economist magazine's Economist Intelligence Unit. John, good morning.
Morning.
We're going to get to the winners and the losers, I suppose, in just a second. But those five categories, tell us, how do you calculate livability? What does that really mean?
Well, what we do is we have correspondents in each city, and we score a number of indicators within each category. So, for example, in stability, we will score violent crime, the threat of unrest, factors like that. And these scores are all assigned individual weights, and then we come up with an index based on an overall score out of 100. So 100 is seen as perfect and 0 is seen as intolerable. And Vancouver came up with 98, which is pretty close to the top.
They sure did. So we're talking about the winners, Vancouver at the top. And you go down, it's really Australia, New Zealand, and Canada who've done the best. Vienna, Australia, is number 2. I'm going down the list now. Melbourne, Australia, Toronto, Calgary. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Vienna is in Austria.
What did I say?
Australia.
Oh, okay. Quick geography lesson for Todd Zwillick. Vienna, Austria, Melbourne, Australia, Toronto, Calgary, Helsinki, on down the list. The rest in Australia or New Zealand. Auckland rounds out the list. Is there anything common that these cities have at the top? You mentioned one of the categories is healthcare. Now, this has to be apart from whether or not the country has good healthcare. This is like access to a hospital in your neighborhood.
Yeah, we have city-specific and national indicators for healthcare. Generally speaking, they'll be nationally set anyway. So, any given cities in a country will probably perform quite similarly. It is things like private healthcare, public healthcare. I do have a theory about why Australian and Canadian cities come at the top.
Please.
You notice that cities in countries with relatively low population densities,
yes,
tend to do well. I think that's because they have good communications infrastructure because of the distance between cities. But also the cities aren't overburdened in the same way as larger cities might be. So you'll have less crime, less sort of pressure on infrastructure for example transport and congestion, and those things make a city more livable.
Now talk about congestion and pollution. Give us a sense of the bottom of the list, if you would.
At the bottom of the survey, we have some cities which probably are in the press for the wrong reasons. Places like Harare in Zimbabwe and Dhaka in Bangladesh. But the main problem with these locations is more about stability. Instability tends to mean that other areas like infrastructure tend to fall down as well.
Infrastructure falls down. Pollution a factor. I've been in some of these cities. Unbelievably crowded. Dakar, Senegal, wonderful place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there, to be perfectly frank.
No, I agree.
Just crowded and polluted, really.
Yes. I mean, you find that in a lot of African countries and Asian countries as well, I guess.
All right, John Kobstake, editor of the Livability Survey for the Economist Intelligence Unit, the top 10 most livable cities in the nation and the bottom 10. Well, the crown goes to Vancouver, as though they haven't had enough attention this week. Not all, go for the games, stay for everything else.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley, sitting here with Todd Zwillick, who is sitting in for John Hockenberry. Coming up, and the dogs, they run home, and a good morning sun. We talk about the relationship, the special bond between man and his best friend. Is it healthy? We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in the Middle East today to gather support for the administration's plan for Iran. Speaking earlier, she said Iran's Revolutionary Guard has become too strong and could supplant the government.
I would like to figure out a way to handle it in as peaceful an approach possible, but we don't want to be engaging while they're building their bomb.
Mrs. Clinton travels to Saudi Arabia today. She wants the Saudi rulers to help persuade the Chinese to take a tougher stand against Iran over its nuclear program.
As we've been talking about all morning, today is the third day of a major military offensive in the city of Marja in Afghanistan. Latest reports say multiple firefights are holding up the U.S. advance in the city. Large numbers of bombs planted by the Taliban are also being cleared. For the latest on this story, we are joined now by Martin Patience, BBC Kabul correspondent. Martin, what are you hearing about the fighting in Marja so far today?
Well, that's right. There have been reports of gun battles, some of which have lasted for several hours in Marja City. That's where US Marines are focusing their operations. And what they're trying to do is to take back that town from Taliban control. But as we understand it, there are some Taliban fighters holed up. They're possibly foreign fighters, and they're firing back. And you're right in pointing out that the progress there has been slow. It's a built-up area, and there are many booby traps. Now, these booby traps and improvised explosive devices have killed and maimed many foreign forces in the past, and they are a deadly threat. And one commander on the ground said it could take up to 30 days to completely clear the town of insurgents. So certainly there's still a lot of fighting.
I think Martin just left us. That was Martin Patience, BBC Kabul correspondent, talking about the fighting in Marja, U.S. Marines and Afghanistan forces.
Back at home, the oldest death row inmate in the United States has died of natural causes. 94-year-old Viva Leroy Nash had a criminal record dating back to the 1930s. His lawyer, Thomas Phelan, says he should never have gotten the death penalty.
But you must understand, Mr. Nash had a profound mental illness even before senile dementia setting.
And China is offering billions of dollars in infrastructure aid to lure North Korea into nuclear disarmament talks. The South Korean news agency is reporting the $10 billion investment will go into building railroads and harbors in North Korea. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning. The Westminster Dog Show opens up in New York City today, and in honor of that, we are having our own takeaway dog show. You have until 10 a.m. Eastern to post the pictures of your dog. We're going to be voting on Best in Show along with a couple other categories. But, you know, here's an interesting fact. The dog show is the only sporting event. The only sporting event that is older than the dog show is the Kentucky Derby.
Really?
And back in 1877, when the first dog show began, the prize was pearl-handled pistols. But it's not just professional trainers that pamper their pooches. Lots of people claim their dog is spoiled rotten. They're probably right. What is this bond that is between us and our best friends? Why do we love dogs so much? We're joined now by two writers who've thought a lot about this. Michael Schaefer's a journalist and the author of the book One Nation Underdog. He joins us in Philadelphia. And here with us in New York is Julie Clam. She's author of the forthcoming book, You Had Me at Woof, How Dogs Taught Me the Secrets of Happiness. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Michael, you did years of research on your book, I understand, and I'm wondering, you know, this obsession with dogs, it's not quite so bad in any other nation, and it hasn't been the case in years past. So how have we become so obsessed with our dogs?
Yeah, I spent a couple of years sort of traveling around, like exploring American pet mania and doing a tour of pet-crazed country. And, you know, for most people, they said that the major change had been in the last 20, 30 years. And I think that the change, you really see what's going on if you go to a pet cemetery. They're very old pet cemeteries. We've always loved our pets. But if you look at the gravestones from like the 1890s will say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant, or something like that. And by the time you get into the middle of the 20th century, it'll be, you know, here lies Fido, man's best friend. And the most recent gravestones or the tributes you see online or whatever will say, you know, mommy loves you or daddy's little girl or our little boy, things like that. And there's really been this kind of promotion of the pet from a servant to friend to now family member. And, you know, once you do that, that kind of then you start applying all of your human standards of whether it's about organic food or about getting the best medicine or about hiring a highly trained trainer. You start applying all of those to the way you take care of your pet.
Julie, I have to ask you, you know, what he's talking about, treating dogs like humans, is something that not just Cesar Millan points to, but other veterinarians have pointed to as not being healthy for the dogs. And you've said that sometimes it can be a strain in your relationship with your family. How do we make this more healthy for both humans and dogs?
Well, I'm not the person to ask about that. I do Boston Terrier Rescue, and my home is a revolving doggy door of new friends. And my husband is a little strained by that. He goes to work in the morning and comes home, and there'll be a dog there who wasn't when he left. And he has questions.
It's a little worse than buying shoes, Julie.
It is. He comes in and says, that's not our dog. And I say, no, that's Edgar.
Now our dog.
He's staying here for a few. And he's fine. He's a great dog. You'll love him. He's housebroken. And then Edgar will go over and pee on Paul's stack of staved New Yorkers. And we all laugh.
Ha ha ha.
Oh, we don't all laugh. I laugh.
I bet Paul doesn't
Nobody
laugh.
Laughs.
But Michael, you know, if you go to our website, you'll see the slideshow at thetakeaway.org. People love their dogs, and you'll see some very pampered dogs. Mine not accepted. My beagle is definitely spoiled rotten. But as you heard me say, veterinarians have been warning us that this is not necessarily the best thing for our dogs. Did you find any insight on how to have maybe a healthier relationship?
You know, I think that we spend a lot of time beating ourselves up for the way we take care of our pets. And a lot of the sort of upgrade in pet care is just a financial decision like any other, and I don't think it hurts the pet. It doesn't hurt the pet to get better food than you used to get. It doesn't hurt the pet to spend more on medical care than you might have spent or to hire a trainer. These things might hurt your wallet and so on, but it's not like, you know, people have a really sort of emotional reaction to that as if, you know, you're by feeding this dog better food, you are somehow not giving money to charity or doing something humane. And I think usually for most people, by feeding their pet better food, they're maybe denying themselves a flat screen TV or something. I think that's the trade off. There are some places where there's an expectation of kind of human type reactions and emotions on the pet's part, which they're not capable of, and then people will feel disappointed with their experience with the new dog. But I think that is much rarer. And for all that the world of our pets has changed, I think it really says a lot about us, and it doesn't. And it's not really something to beat ourselves up over.
Julie, the obsession with dogs, veterinarians say, mm-hmm. may be leading to more separation anxiety on the cause of dogs. Have you seen this among your own dogs?
I think my dogs have separation anxiety if I walk from the couch to the bathroom. But they are just used to being with me, very, very close. My dogs, you know, focus on me, and, you know, they're in a constant state of jubilance if I look at them. So we
do
don't.
Do you give that kind of attention to your husband?
Yeah.
I don't believe you somehow, Julie Clam, author of the forthcoming book, You Had Me at Woof. Michael, do people sometimes let their family relationships suffer a little bit as they're giving all this attention to their dogs?
There's definitely some of that. A lot of people have a hard time sort of separating the two. And, you know, I think one of the things that's happened is that people who used to be in categories where they would say, don't get a dog, you know, if you're single, say, or if you're in a two-career couple, which are much more common than they used to be, they are now getting dogs, and there's this whole kind of infrastructure of services to help you take care of that.
Thanks to both of you for joining us. That's Michael Schaefer. He's the author of One Nation Under One Dog. And the Westminster Dog Show is starting today in New York. We're having our own dog show here at The Takeaway, so you have until 10 a.m. Eastern today to send in the photo of your pet. It is very, very soon, so go to thetakeaway.org for directions on how to send yours. And then the judging begins. You're actually the judges, so go to our site, thetakeaway.org, to vote. And we're also taking your comments on, what do you think? Are we too obsessed with our pets? And is it healthy for you? Is it healthy for your dog? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
While you're there, you can keep the conversation going on any topic in the news that has you talking. We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning, which has got off to a sad start when a loser died during practice last Friday. But have some sports gotten too dangerous? We're looking for your takeaway. Manuel posts to our site, the IOC is capitulating to children, as so many other institutions have done. 17-year-olds need to be told what to do, not the other way around. We need to consider why youths won't watch athletic competition that's not dangerous just to satisfy their morbid caprice. Well, youths also have a lot more money than they used to. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Post your comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.